The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cash Life Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
John, it is so good to see you. We are here with our first episode of season three of the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. I cannot believe we have made it to season three.
Yeah, me neither. I'm so excited that people are still coming back to listen to us and my annoying puns. So get ready for a whole season of them.
We are ready, and we look forward to disappointing, not disappointing us. I guess it depends on your perspective of how you feel like Sean's puns rate on the scale of
it's
incredible
a good pun.
To like maybe disappointing. We'll see. Let us know. Tweet at us.
Which way disappointing, I guess, is the question. Is if the pun is too bad or too good, is it disappointing? But you can tell us that too.
And on that note, welcome back. We are here to the season three of the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine, our mini series on substance use disorders. I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Dr. Sean Cohen. And today we just have a real fantastic episode for everybody on methadone in the outpatient setting to follow up with Dr. Ruth Pody and Dr. David Frank. But before we get started with that, Sean, will you remind the audience, what do we do here on the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine?
I would love to. We are the Addiction Med Podcast, and we use expert interviews, often again with people that we idolize, learn from, to demystify common addiction med topics, reduce stigma, and inspire listeners to be fierce advocates for all individuals who use substances. And all those things are going to really come through in this episode. And so, as a reminder, our episodes are available for CME through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And by listening to these episodes and completing the CME, they count towards that new DEA 8-hour requirement for substance use disorders education. So double trouble for you.
And I think it's really important to say we wouldn't be here without our incredible partners. So this podcast is brought to you by the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM, and they offer a variety of products that can help support your professional development and career journey. Stay up to date on the latest addiction medicine with their professional practice bundle, or ensure that you are ready to pass the ABPM board exam with ACAM's board prep bundle. ACAM has the resources you need to excel in addiction medicine through networking, fellowship opportunities, and additional educational resources. So be sure to visit ACAM at acaam.org.
Woo! I love ACAM. So make sure you check it out. They have some, again, great cases and board prep and lots of good resources for kind of continuing education and hopefully becoming an addiction med expert. Okay, so we had two amazing guests today. First of all, we had Dr. Ruth Pody, who is a board-certified family physician, addiction med physician who works in Western Massachusetts. She's a medical director for the Behavioral Health Network and Franklin County House of Corrections and oversees five opioid treatment programs, including the first fully licensed jail OTP in the country. And she's also converted 3/4 of her lawn to a native plant pollinator corridor and is a multi-generational composter. And as someone who's just getting into composting, this is very intriguing to me. So excited to talk to her. Our second amazing guest is Dr. David Frank, who is a medical sociologist, assistant research scientist at New York University School of Global Health, as well as someone who uses drugs and has been on methadone maintenance for about 20 years. His work focuses primarily on methadone maintenance treatment and uses structural perspectives to problematize the use of addiction and recovery narratives to conceptualize medication-assisted treatment. And he also plays guitar and hangs out with his cats, which if you watch the YouTube version, you'll get to see his cat with a very cute name, and you'll see their tail throughout the video. And so together, they teach us some really amazing things. We talk through the amazing medication that methadone is and kind of the system that it exists within. We hear what it's like from kind of a person that's engaging with methadone from their point of view. And I think we get some tips and tricks as to how you, as a general physician, as a primary care physician, can advocate for people to get the best possible care through opioid treatment programs where methadone is provided and what actually happens at those clinics. And so, without further ado, we will teach you the methadoos and the methadones of methadone.
I was waiting for it. Okay. David, we are so excited to have you on our show today. This is the lightning round where we're just going to ask a couple of rapid fire questions to get to know you a little bit better. Can you please give us a one-liner to describe yourself?
Sure. I am a medical sociologist and a research scientist at New York University. I am also a person who uses drugs, a person who's been on methadone maintenance for close to 20 years now, and a lifelong punk rocker who plays guitar and hangs out with cats a lot.
I feel like I learned so much about you from that one-liner. So it's a very good one-liner. Have you been playing guitar for a long time?
Yeah. Well, I mean, only because I'm old. Yeah, I guess I started playing when I was like 15 or 16, and now I'm 52. So yeah, it's been a long time.
And is there anything else? So you have a cat that I've seen come by a couple times. What is it, one cat or a couple? What are their names?
It's one cat named Mr. Cousteau, and he might come by. You know, he likes to hang out in meetings and kind of walk back and forth and sometimes causes a little bit of chaos. So you might see him.
He sounds so refined with that name, Mr. Cousteau.
Yeah. No, he's a like a lot of like male cats, or maybe this is maybe I'm generalizing, but he is a codependent wimp who needs to sleep in bed, and you know he's very much like a dog cat kind of.
I have a cat dog that like climbs on the top of couches and very cat like dogs.
Cool. Yeah, I see them together.
And David, do you have a favorite aspect of working in the field of addiction medicine?
Oh, I have a few. I mean, I guess my favorite is that it gives me a voice to comment on issues that I never thought I would be able to comment on. As I'm sure it'll come out sort of in the episode, you know, I was a longtime drug user, heroin user, injection drug user. And even when I got on methadone before I had gone to graduate school, you know, I had all these ideas and thoughts, but I knew no one would really take me seriously unless I could get into the space either professionally with a degree or just as an advocate, neither of which I was in at the time. So now that I am sort of in that space, I love, you know, being able to comment on these issues that are important to me. And I also like the philosophical aspects. I think addiction as a topic is very, it gives us room to comment on a lot of sort of philosophical issues, objective versus subjective, bodily autonomy, things like that. So yeah, it's a great topic that feeds into a lot of other interesting topics.
Well, we are so excited to have you here and that your voice is in the space. I think it's time to get to know our second guest a little bit better, who is not new to the show. But Ruth, do you mind just reminding us and giving us a one-liner about yourself?
Hi, everyone. I'm so glad to be here. I'm a 55-year-old woman. I'm in the final one-third of my medical career, I think. And I feel like each one-third, I'm blowing up something different. So I have another third to blow up different things. But methadone has so much work to be done that it's going to take probably the rest of my long career to be able to do the work that needs to happen.
What did you blow up the first third?
I'm a reproductive health advocate and an abortion provider. And so I have done a lot of work training family medicine physicians in reproductive health issues. It's still something I feel very strongly about. And if I were able to be cloned, I would absolutely be running an abortion clinic in New Mexico right now. I think about it all the time.
Well, I wish you were able to be cloned, but I'm glad you could impart your knowledge to another group of family med docs and get them working too. How did you go from there to addiction med and methadone and everything?
I no longer have my own kids at home. They've all launched, but I host at my own house residents and medical students and addiction fellows and help train them. And one of the things I say to them is, you have a long career ahead of you and you can do 50 different things. And as a family physician, where your scope of practice is so wide, it actually makes so much sense that you get really good at many things. And then as society needs you to step into a void to help, then you should step into that void if it's a passion of yours. So I don't know, it made total sense to go from reproductive justice work to advocacy for people who use drugs. And they all combine with each other. Providing actually reproductive health options at OTPs is really important too.
Yeah.
I see a lot of similarities between those two.
Yeah. I'm always so impressed about how I feel like most of the family med docs that I've met and trainees are so like, advocacy is so ingrained and changing the system is so ingrained. Like, I'm always so impressed by how cool they are and how much of a badass everybody is. So,
oh, totally. And as you said, the breadth of the services and the care they can provide is just incredible.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so excited to have you both. Sean, do you want to kick us off and tell us about a case from Cashlack Memorial?
Yeah, I'd love to start us off. So we are seeing Miss M, who's a 32-year-old woman who we know as a primary care doctor. She has a history of severe opioid use disorder and current severe opioid use disorder, who's injecting fentanyl. She's previously been, because you are an amazing primary care doctor who provides buprenorphine, she's been treated with buprenorphine before, both kind of sublingual versions and extended release formulations, but just never really met her goals, which was reduction of use and kind of less chaotic use due to continued cravings on buprenorphine. She's never really been on methadone or interacted with the methadone system and asks if you can prescribe it to her at your clinic. And so I just kind of wanted to start kind of broad scope as a refresher from our amazing first episode about methadone that you were on with us, Ruth. But can you remind us about methadone, its pharmacology, how it's a little bit different than buprenorphine too?
Of course. So many of your listeners know this already, but methadone is a full agonist opiate and buprenorphine is an agonist antagonist. And these days, one of the struggles we have with buprenorphine is because it is this boss drug that has this very strong affinity with the mu receptor, it shoves everything in its way out of its way. So to get on buprenorphine, often people are sick first before they get stable, and that sickness can last hours or even days. So it no longer is as easy as it used to be due to the long-acting nature of fentanyl to get onto buprenorphine. And that's not true for methadone. Methadone is a pure agonist, sort of sidles its way onto the mu receptor. It doesn't need to push anybody out of the way. It sort of joins the fray. And it makes people feel better. It is very effective against fentanyl. And one of the most important things I will say about methadone is it has this huge window of therapy that some people are stable at 60 milligrams, some people don't get stable till they're at 200 twice a day, and that everybody has their own window where they sit. It looks a lot the way that thyroid replacement looks. You have patients who take 200 micrograms of thyroid replacement, or they take 12.5. And it took you a while as their primary care doctor to figure that out. Methadone is a lot like that. It has a long half-life. It builds up in the system. It takes a little while to get to a stable dose. It's oral bioavailability is excellent. So you swallow it and it gets absorbed. It's 95, 98% bioavailable. And buprenorphine, at least the sublingual version, is not like that. Its bioavailability can be as low as 30 to 40% depending on how you take it.
I've had a lot of patients in my own practice be more interested in methadone, as you said, because there's so much more fentanyl out there and it is really changing the game of how we practice and how we care for folks with opioid use disorder. And I think you said because of its long-acting nature, it's kind of like that it's like that lipophilic property that sort of causes it to store in our adipose tissue cells, where like it acts short-acting. Because I think a lot of my learners are saying, "Hey, isn't it only short-acting? Right? We see it in the hospital for folks who are going to the surgery, and it's also actually a little different for people who are using it every day. It kind of like, as you said, acts like a long-acting opioid, even though its kind of like duration of acute like onset is kind of short."
I mean, it's patients who taught me everything I know about fentanyl. It's a garbage drug, and nobody really wants to be using it, yet it's all that most of us have available in the community. Patients will say, it doesn't last long. Sometimes I need to use it every day, every hour of every day, to not get sick. And yet, remnants of it are staying in your body. We're seeing drug tests positive for fentanyl 40 days after somebody last used. And it's those remnants that are getting in the way of buprenorphine being able to lock in and not make you sick. So again, buprenorphine has been a life-saving drug for so many people. It's so effective. And yet these days, it's just a challenge to get onto the right dose. And just what you said, Carolyn, it makes methadone rise as a good contender for treatment in spite of how hard it is to get into a methadone clinic.
And Ruth, in a broad scope, can you tell us a little bit about the difference in how methadone is regulated in our country?
Yeah. So the rules on methadone were originally written in 1973. It was during the Nixon era and the war on drugs. A lot of the original studies on methadone from the 1960s really talked about its treatment of the quote-unquote criminal addict. Rikers, prison in New York City was one of the earliest places where methadone was used. And one of the selling points of methadone is it reduced crime. It built the system of methadone outside of any other part of normal medical care that really has at its foundation a very carceral surveillance model of care. There's nothing else in medicine that looks like this. And yet it's been there now for 51 years. And what's extraordinary is that it hasn't changed much in all of that time. So here we have what a lot of us call a miracle molecule that people can't access in normal medical venues. That's the problem with methadone. It's not the molecule. It's the fact that the delivery system is so inaccessible to so many people, literally inaccessible, because 80% of the counties in our country do not have methadone clinics.
And I think it's worth emphasizing, right, the miracle aspect too. I mean, this is true for buprenorphine too, but I mean, the data for methadone is so much, it goes so much back so much longer and it's kind of more robust, but like both decrease your risk of more like deaths from overdose and deaths in general by 50%. It's like wacky to me. And I assume everybody, hopefully that's listening, but definitely everybody that's here recording that like, these are like the most effective medications we can prescribe in a clinic, except one of them we actually can't prescribe in a clinic, right? And I appreciate you kind of giving some context of like, it was built as a medication, like a carceral medication for a reason, because we were treating people that we considered criminals. And again, that is super stigmatizing and kind of some of the ethos that still pervades the system we see today too.
Right. So unfortunately, for our case, we can't actually prescribe methadone in primary care at this time for our patient. So we explained to Ms. M that it is only available at opioid treatment programs in the U.S. Fortunately, they do have access to an OTP clinic nearby that you're aware of has openings for new patients. Ms. M tells you she'd like to go, but she wants to know a little bit more about what the process would look like. So I'm going to ask this question first to you, David. Can you actually walk us through what the experience is like from a person with lived experience point of view of what's it like to actually go through and walk into a methadone clinic?
Well, the first thing I would say is there's a lot of variables. It's going to depend on what state you live in, the actual clinic you go to. There's a lot of variety, even at the clinic level, which is part of the problem in trying to fix some of these difficulties with methadone, is there's really no rhyme or reason, and it's really complicated what determines how the differences between one clinic and another. But that all said, it's scary to walk into a methadone clinic. It's likely that you're probably sort of at the end of your rope. Had using heroin been sustainable, you would continue to use heroin. And you tend to get on methadone when, you know, when the card castle is falling down around you. So you're scared, you're desperate. It is a carceral setting, and that's clear. And again, there some clinics are different, but, you know, you go in, it doesn't look like a doctor's office. It looks like a big room. You notice the line might be out the door. In fact, it often is out the door. Of grumbling people early in the morning, waiting to get their dose, lined up outside a window that is often bulletproof glass. You are probably dope sick. Well, you might be dope sick. I mean, hopefully you took some before you went, just to deal with the intake process. But you might be dope sick. And you got to go through an induction process, which is like, you know, paperwork bureaucracy asking you a bunch of your age, your drug use history, that kind of thing. And all you probably want at that point is to be dosed, to get some medication so you feel better. And in most cases, you're only going to get 30 milligrams of methadone on your first day, because they don't, you know, there's some legitimate reasons, you know, that we're not sure how much, you know, how big your habit is. So they're going to push you up slowly, although the new rules have changed this a little bit. So yeah, you'll meet with the counselor, and you know, it's kind of like a whirlwind. However, I do remember getting out of the clinic on my first day, walking home to my house, and sort of it dawning on me in amazement, being like, oh my God, I'm not going to get dope sick today. I'm not going to have to spend the rest of this day trying to lie and scheme and steal and take buses and get dope. And then I was like, and tomorrow that, you know, I get to go back and they'll give me more. And it was sort of this amazing moment where I was like, all of the difficulty that goes on in trying to be a criminalized drug user was sort of solved. And I was kind of like, wow, I might never get dope sick again. That hasn't totally been true, but it's been largely true. And so, yeah, so it's difficult and bureaucratic and a pain in the neck. But at the end, you know, you get to be like, wow, I found a better source of dope.
And this is for, I think, either of you, but like roughly, and again, I know every clinic is different. Unfortunately, there's a lot of variability, and hopefully the ones that we send most of our patients to are the better ones. But how long, like when we're prepping people, like are we telling them it's going to take 30 minutes, an hour, 4 hours, 12 hours? Like, do you have a sense in general where it lies?
I think I was pretty lucky. I know I've been pretty lucky in my clinics. By the way, Mr. Cousteau is joining the meeting. At least his tail is. I think my intake was an hour, you know, something like that. I've heard much worse stories from other people, and it depends on, you know, the lines and how busy they are and, you know, that kind of thing. But I think mine was an hour.
I love having David's voice on this, and I love David, and I've known each other for a while now, and it's extremely important that people understand the patient's perspective of walking into a clinic and being at the end of your rope and being terrified. And if I said that that's who you're taking care of today, you would devise a lovely, beautiful, safe, welcoming place for that person to go. And what he described is true. I mean, methadone clinics are really often wrong side of the tracks. They can often be in sort of neighborhoods where you don't feel safe. They're often in neighborhoods where actually you normally score drugs. So you're surrounded by all your people and places, and you're trying to get better. And that is also part of the challenge. I'm glad that David's experience of an intake in 1 hour happened for him. I actually don't think that's common. I think people should be prepared for a 4-hour intake. They should be prepared for waiting. They'll have to offer often a urine drug screen. And in clinics that are trying to get through as many things as possible, they're trying to actually serve you well in the sense that the more checkoff boxes they can get through on day one, the less you'll have to do later. But it does make day one hard. And something David said, I think, is really important. If you walk in and you're really heavily under the influence, they're not going to dose you. And they could dose you the next day, but they'll say to you, you got to show up tomorrow and you can't be so under the influence. Now, there are places where in there are certain states, I'm going to name California as a state, where actually in part of the guidelines that are written by CSAN, the California Addiction Society, a medicine organization, they say you have to be arriving quite sick and you have to be scoring greater than a 10 on a COWS. That means you do not use in the parking lot before you walk in. And that for me is a real barrier to care. You should not have to be only, you know, getting your treatment when you're already sick. You just need to not show up under the influence or apparently under the influence.
I would imagine it must be so difficult trying to get through an intake process when you're in withdrawal and trying to answer questions. Yeah, I know that sounds like a bad policy forcing people to be dope sick. One thing I did want to point out that the clinic's experience doesn't have to be that way. Like now I go to a clinic, it's sometimes called medical maintenance, where I get to go upstairs and I feel bad because I leave the more carceral setting and go upstairs to what looks like a doctor's office. And there's about six people in there that only go once every month to get their methadone. It's not carceral. It looks like a patient's waiting room. And I always feel both relieved and guilty when I go to my clinic because the downstairs is that total, you know, carceral, bulletproof glass setting. So it doesn't have to be that way.
And we're throwing around this word carceral, but there are guards there. There are uniformed officers, and sometimes they actually are police officers or correctional officers. It's not a safe feeling place. And as somebody who's a primary care doctor, I've never worked in a primary care clinic myself that had a guard as soon as you walk in the door. And there are cameras and surveillance everywhere. That's part of the regulations about a methadone clinic is that high security must be present. You cannot dose a patient if security is not present.
Yeah. As that really comes through, and it's probably came through earlier, and it's going to come through the whole time of this like really stark dichotomy of like, amazing medication. Like David, you were talking about how like it dawned on you of like, oh my God, like this is going to help. I'm going to feel better. This is going to help my life. Even if you're like trying to pitch someone on methadone, I guess convince them to start methadone, because again, it's this miracle molecule. Like, how do you talk them through so that they have the right expectations so that they can get through this process?
For me, it's a very nuanced, often difficult process. And I get, and it depends a lot on where the person lives. I grew up in Florida, so I have a lot of friends calling me from Florida being like, oh man, you know, my habit's out of control. I'm in trouble. What do I do? And I wanted, you know, they know I'm on methadone, and I'm like, well, you know, methadone would definitely help, but I know they're in Florida, and I know it's probably going to be like, you know, just the worst possible version of this sort of carceral difficult experience. That said, you know, I do tell them that, you know, that there aren't a lot of options, and you know, people that use illegal drugs, we know that there aren't a lot of options for us. You know, we're used to like the bottom of the barrel, and we try to eke out whatever survival we can based on that. So, yeah, what I mostly tell people is, look, you're not going to be dope sick again, and you're going to be able to have a life. And then, you know, hopefully you could, once you get to that point, you could start negotiating and find a clinic that's more harm reduction, it's better, you could get a little room to move. And it's a compelling argument for people that are, you know, pushed up against the wall and have been sick every single day, wake up, you know, you got to do something. So yeah, I mean, it's those pragmatic things that I think are most compelling to people that are using illegal drugs, that like, I can have a life again. I won't spend all of my days trying to score. And most importantly, I won't be dope sick.
Do you hear that, what David just said, which is that it really depends on your clinic? If I'm having a massive anterior wall MI and I show up at an ER in Florida or in Cincinnati or in Boston, I'm going to get the exact same medical care, period. And yet you can walk down a mile apart methadone clinics and receive very different care. Same drugs being given to you, but how you're treated, how the policies and state and federal rules are put into place are completely different. And we need to rise to the top and to put under a beautiful, bright spotlight this minority of methadone clinics in this country that are doing an amazing job, that are really patient-centered, that are really reading the rules and being as progressive as possible and getting people safely to the right dose and getting the take-home bottles that they deserve to have freedom so they can live their lives. We talk about the mortality decrease with methadone, and Sean said it earlier, at least a 50% drop in mortality. But really, just the effectiveness at being able to live a quality life is really high. Whether people stop using or not, it's not relevant, honestly. If they choose to decrease their use or choose to stop, no matter what, their life is better on methadone, right? Just it is. You're not exposed to the toxic garbage that's available on our street. And people really build their lives back on track in this really successful way. As a family doctor, there's never been a medication that I've ever written for that is as effective as this one, except for birth control. Birth control is extremely effective, and it falls in that same category.
It really is amazing. I mean, I can't emphasize enough how much it turned my life around, as problematic as the system is. Even with that, you know, when I got on methadone, this is about maybe 2004. I was living in Chicago. I was on probation. I'd been arrested a couple times. I was, I was married at the time. My wife was also, using heroin. You know, we were always late for rent, unstably housed. Every single day was pure chaos and crime and lying. All our families had, long ago abandoned us. And it was just trying to survive. And shortly after getting on methadone, you know, within like a couple of days, I was like, I'm going grocery shopping. I could sit here and watch TV. I could apply for a job and know that I'll be able to go to that job without having to like score on my lunch break. And then, of course, you know, now at this point, I've got a PhD and all that. I mean, none of that would have been possible, even remotely possible, without methadone. And speaking to the difference in clinics, when I moved from Chicago to New York, which is where I live now, I moved because I was to go to my PhD program at CUNY. I was terrified because of these differences in clinics that we're talking about. I was at the time getting 28 days of take-homes. And I was very aware that it was likely that if when I moved to New York and switched clinic, boom, I was going to have to go back to daily dosing while trying to be on a PhD program. That would have been just impossible. Luckily, I went online and was like, hey, harm reductionists, where's the clinic that's going to be cool, that's going to, you know, grandfather in my take-homes? And I found out that way, which speaks to both the diversity of clinics, and it speaks to a lot of things. But yeah, it would have been completely impossible to try to progress in my path, you know, going to a clinic every day at 5 a.m.
First of all, I really appreciate kind of giving like this human element of like, again, the impact that methadone truly has, not just on like big numbers of mortality, but truthfully, like how it gives people their life back. And but speaking of kind of how variable clinics are, what are like the must do's for a clinic, especially kind of in the intake process, like counseling groups? I know you mentioned urine drug screens. Like, what are the things that people absolutely have to get done?
So the rules are very specific at a federal level, and then states then apply additional rules on top. So depending on what state you are, I may not list all the rules that might impact a patient at a methadone clinic. But a full physical examination by a provider at a clinic, and now that provider can be an MD, a DO, a nurse practitioner, or a physician assistant. But you have to have a full physical exam done within 14 days of arrival. Many clinics, you have to actually see that prescriber before you can even start. Urine drug screens, or any drug screen, it can be an oral mouth swab or another drug screen, at a minimum must be done 8 times a year. Many states require more than that. So at a minimum, 8 times a year. Counseling from a federal standpoint is not a requirement of going to a methadone clinic. And in fact, the new final rules that came out as of April 2nd make it very clear that no one should be denied access to methadone if they refuse counseling. Now, again, your individual state may mandate counseling. Your individual state insurance companies may mandate counseling. So there's multiple levels where that mandate could come, but it's not at the federal level. The other things that are required is a lab evaluation. They don't specify exactly what labs to get. In general, they sort of leave it up to for evidence-based screening for harm reduction. Very specifically spelled out in the final rule is that you cannot discharge or not treat somebody because they refuse a lab evaluation. And our patient population has really hard venous access. And sometimes this is this sticking point of you didn't get your labs done in 14 days, and they'll say, it is impossible to get blood out of my body. I would need to be in an operating room with a central line. And yet it becomes a sticking point. So again, the new federal guidelines are very clear. No one should be discharged for that. And we just have them sign a form basically saying, I have bad venous access, or I have trauma around access. And we just say, we're not going to do it. So those are the major requirements that somebody should anticipate in a clinic. David mentioned it. He mentioned that he was from Florida originally. In the 9 states that have not expanded the Affordable Care Act, addiction coverage is not mandated by public insurance. So Affordable Care Act mandates that all addiction care is covered by insurance. But in those states, most of which are in the South, methadone clinics are a cash business. And David maybe can jump in on that. But it does mean locally access can be really limited by your inability to pay.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I know a number of people, and no surprise, when people are ready to go to a methadone clinic, they're probably having financial difficulties as well. But yeah, I know a bunch of people who've been, it's sometimes called fetoxed, where if you don't have enough money, they will quickly reduce your dose as a means of kicking you out. Or some people just know they can't afford it at the outset and avoid it for that reason. And of course, it becomes really complicated, more complicated than I understand, but I certainly know that those financial barriers are huge and prevent people from getting treatment.
And I know in our first episode with you, Ruth, that you actually talked about the methadone checklist. Like, there are these things we should make sure our patients have before we refer. Do you mind just reviewing those briefly with us? Because I think if you're approaching this person in your primary care office, we probably should be checking to make sure that if they show up to clinic, they'll actually be able to be qualified, you know, to walk in the door and start treatment.
Excellent, Claire. Thanks for reminding me of that one, Carolyn. So one is a government-issued ID with a photo ID. Now, some states don't require this, or they have really expanded the definition, but I'm gonna work with the presumption that I'm talking to the states with the worst restriction. So showing up with a government-issued photo ID matters. And that's hard for a lot of our patients. A lot of our patients don't have driver's licenses, or they've lost their driver's license. And for those of you who have had to go pay for a new ID, it's expensive. So that is one thing that one would need. Being insured or having money to pay for it is a major rate limiting step. So here you are, this is a patient in your primary care clinic. My hope is they're insured. But also there's a chance that the local OTP doesn't take their insurance. What if that's a problem? You know, people might have private insurance that doesn't cover methadone. So the Affordable Care Act requires public coverage of addiction, but there's lots of private insurance that says, no, we don't take care of the addicts. I mean, you see that all the time. Another thing is actually being able to get to the clinic. It's a really, that for me is a dividing line where I say, look, I think methadone's the right medicine for you, but you and I know you live in a hill town. You live 100 miles from me. You and I mostly work on telehealth because you can't get in. How's that person going to get to a clinic every day? It's just not going to happen. And so that access, true physical access to the clinic, telehealth does not solve for that. I mean, I'm happy. These days, you can do an audio visual telehealth intake of the patient. I can sit and talk to Carolyn and say, well, I think methadone's the right medicine for you. We can do it on a screen. But the dosing of the methadone has got to be in person. There's no way around that.
I think that's the biggest problem is the biggest barrier to treatment is people getting there, which is a mixture of distance, lack of clinics in places, and hugely conservative views on providing take-home doses. This is the biggest one. If you're going to ask somebody to show up, you know, every day, that's impossible for anybody, you know, and it's certainly going to be impossible if you're also telling them, we want you to get a job, we want you to go to school, we want you to be doing these kinds of things, and we want you showing up here every day for an unspecified amount of time, because you never know how long it's going to take. You're waiting in that line. Half the time, right when you think it's about time for you to finally dose, they'll be like, oh, you know, David Frank, your counselor needs to see you before you dose. Then you got to go back there, and you're like, oh my God, I'm late for work already, and now, it's a stigmatized medicine. I can't just tell my boss, you know, oh, it's methadone clinic. That's the hugest problem, is forcing people to go either every day or even multiple times a week is just not feasible. It's just not practical. So many clinics do it.
And I want to say as well, even the time the clinics are open for dosing can vary quite a bit. So depending on what shift someone works, I've been told as well by patients that's not feasible to go to clinic. And as you said, work their job literally, you know, because they work during the entire window that the clinic is open. So primary care folks may want to actually know, right? Like, what are the hours that your local clinics are open? So that way you can, again, present all the information you can for the patients. And, you know, we've talked a lot, David, you keep mentioning the line at the methadone clinic, right? So like, I don't know if you've never been in a methadone clinic, you know, like what is the line? Like what actually happens in the line? What is the line for? And like, what happens when you're in the line? What are people waiting for?
I mean, as I mentioned, I now am freed from the line because I go upstairs to the medical maintenance, but I have plenty of memories of the line to last a lifetime. And sometimes it's kind of two lines. There's the line for, you know, just checking in, the admin line. You give them your ID and you're like, okay, I'm here. And then you go in the dosing line, which is probably what most people are referring to as the line, where you're waiting to go to a window where the dosing nurse is going to provide you with your dose of medication for the day. And, you know, it's early in the morning. You got a bunch of people, they're grumbling. A lot of them are, you know, selling drugs or being like, oh, you know, do you want to, you know, hook up with this, which is a problem for people who are, you know, trying to not use drugs. But yeah, you slowly get up to this line and there's a nurse at the dosing window who sometimes they, you know, make you open your mouth to make sure that you've actually swallowed your methadone and aren't trying to, you know, sell it outside. But yeah, it's just a long line of waiting to dose. And that's also the fact that you're waiting to get your opioids, your medicine, your drugs, whatever you want to call it. You're probably not feeling good already. It's been 24 hours since your last time. And you're like, oh, this line, I just want my opioids on my receptors as quickly as possible.
I mean, we've talked a little bit about dosing and so like, and kind of how difficult the experience is of waiting. And so Ruth, can you talk us through a little bit of like how long do people need to dose daily? What's the difference? And I think like a little bit, as we've talked about the variability, what's the difference between what the regulations say and what actually happens in clinics?
So the new rule, the final rules, just went into place this month, again on April 2nd. And it's called the final rule. And if you want to look it up, it's on the SAMHSA website, and we're going to put it into the notes of the show. The new rules are pretty clear. On day one, you can get take-home bottles. On day one, walking to a clinic, you could have a week's worth of bottles. And then after being in clinic for, I think it's 2 weeks, you can get as much as 2 weeks of bottles. So it's extraordinary. Having said that, very few places will do that. A new walk-in, walking into clinic for the first time, our patient case that we're describing, it's unlikely someone's going to hand her bottles on day one, partly because she hasn't yet jumped through the minimum requirements that are really required by the federal and state rules. And partly because her dose is not at all stable. And in fact, you might cause more harm to say to somebody, hey, I'm going to start you at 40 or 50 or 60 milligrams of methadone, and I'm not going to change your dose for the next week. That actually could put them in harm's way in the sense that their dose isn't sufficient. Possibly it's too much, but it's more likely they just aren't on enough. And so in the beginning, often people do come every day until they've jumped through the rules and regulation hoops that had to be jumped through. And then they often have to really self-advocate. There's not like an automatic system that says, when you hit this number, the system automatically sees you've done the four required things and will automatically switch you to come to once a week. Most clinics aren't designed that way. Literally, EMRs and the dispensing system has never been designed that way. You can imagine redoing it all so that little flags pop up that don't say, you're in trouble, you haven't done anything. Instead, it says, the clinic has not done enough for you. You need more bottles. You've been here too long. And, you know, lines shouldn't exist at a methadone clinic. There should be an industry standard of like, there's no wait. You should, if you're waiting, our systems at our clinics, you know, they are measuring how long people wait. And if we have people waiting more than 3 minutes, we're asking ourselves something is wrong. When 1,000 patients at an OTP have to dose every day, that's a lot of people. But when 80% of your patients have take-home bottles, they're not coming every day. They might come once a week or twice a month. And so it really decreases the number of people who have to wait in line. Now, having said that, when you show up at the window to pick up your 27 bottles, it takes longer, right? That's a time when the nurse and you are chit-chatting about kids and grandkids, showing pictures and talking about jobs and comparing hairdos, whatever it is you're doing, because it takes a long time for all those bottles to get filled.
That's another thing I want to jump in on. Again, my cool medical maintenance clinic, they don't give me my 28 doses in 28 bottles, which another problem with the bottles is they use oftentimes Kool-Aid to make sure there's liquid in it, which so you got not just 28 bottles, but 28 sticky, wet Kool-Aid bottles that maybe you got to, you know, what if you got to go on a flight or something like that? But my clinic gives me one bottle, just like a prescription bottle of dry medicine. And it's they treat me like an adult enough to be able to break up the wafers into my appropriate daily dose. And that's, of course, how it should be for everybody. But it's hardly that way for anybody. It's mostly you got just a big thing of bottles, which is a million, not just, you know, if you're flying, that's a problem with like cops. And it's just a million problems.
We've been talking a lot about take-home doses. So Ruth, can you tell us a little bit more? What are the current criteria for getting take-home doses in a methadone clinic?
Yeah, there's a 5-point criteria. It used to be an 8-point criteria. It was very specific. And the most important one on that 5-point criteria is that somebody can't have an active substance use disorder. It says nothing about toxicology. So people can have drug screens that might show that they have intermittent cocaine use, or they're going to have fentanyl in their drug screen for quite a while, as we all know, because it stays around for a while. But determining whether somebody has an active substance use disorder is actually a lot of work, and you need some skill in doing it, and you need to sit down with the patient and talk to them. Because people can use drugs intermittently in a controlled fashion and not actually meet DSM-5 criteria for an active substance use disorder. So that's the most important one. That's the one that really tends to get people stuck. You have to be able to keep the medicine safe. You need to be able to keep it locked up. That's a DEA requirement, safe and away from other people. It doesn't mean you have to be housed. You could be unhoused and have take-home bottles. I actually would argue that many people who are unhoused because they have so little access to things, hold on to that backpack. It's the last thing they have because it often is. I actually have a huge amount of faith that those people can manage their bottles because they've proven to me that they can. Again, you need to have met whatever it is that the OTP says you must meet from an insurance standpoint, from a regulatory standpoint. So if you haven't done your comp assessment, you're not going to get take-home bottles because that has got to be done in the first 14 days by the regulation. So there's some regulatory reasons that would also limit your ability to get take-home bottles. If you have an active benzo use disorder or an active alcohol use disorder, you're going to likely not get take-home bottles. Those are the two concerning sedative drugs in conjunction with methadone that can cause you harm. And so until those two substances are under control, I would think most methadone clinics are going to hesitate.
And we've talked about the benefit, you know, of getting take-homes. David, I wonder if you can comment on what happens when people lose access to their take-home doses.
Sure, sure. And I also just want to briefly just add on to what Ruth said. Because these DSM diagnoses are so loosey-goosey, kind of, or I think they're loosey-goosey, but they're difficult to pin down. They're kind of subjective. There's a lot of value statements going on. You know, whether someone has a disorder, it often becomes the treatment provider's belief system. You know, do I think that this person is using drugs in a way that I don't approve of? And that becomes the sort of determining factor, you know, disguised through the DSM, diagnostic language. I mean, our feelings about drugs are, you know, part and parcel of whether or not people are getting their take-homes. It's not just a clear kind of thing, even though it is. You know, maybe they have a little bit more leeway now with the final rule. It still comes down to a lot of beliefs and ideas about drugs and people that use them. That said, when people lose their take-homes, it's a tragedy. I mean, the idea, I can speak for my own, I haven't lost mine, luckily. But if I were to have to go from having a life for many years, being able to just go to my clinic once a month, and then to have to go every day, I mean, for one thing, just practically, it would destroy my life. The way it would affect my view of myself and on methadone, you'd just be like, screw it, man. I'm going to go. Certainly, I'm going to use as much heroin as I want, because why not at this point? Probably want to leave treatment. In fact, I've had numerous people in my research, you know, where I'll be talking to them longitudinally. I'll do interviews over time, and they'll first start out, they're like, oh my God, my clinic's pressuring me to do, in many cases, it's to stop drinking alcohol, which is mind-bogglingly frustrating. Sometimes these are like 22-year-old, like college kids that are going to drink alcohol. And the clinic's like, you know, we're going to take away all your take-homes if you don't stop doing this. You know, I get calls from them. They're scared. They're like, my God, I can't go back. I can't go back to every day, and I can't go back to the fentanyl. What am I going to do? And they have like sort of no way out, and they're crying. They're scared. And then it happens exactly as they feared it would. They lose their take-homes because they drank beer on the weekend. They leave methadone because they have a job and it's impossible for them to maintain their job and still go every day. And then they're back out into the super dangerous, terrifying world of I have to score fentanyl every single day. And in more cases than I'd like to count, they die. They overdose shortly thereafter. So it's like this horrifying thing that they know is going to happen. They're like, I've just been given, I'm given a death sentence. And yes, in fact, that is exactly what happened. So it's a big deal. I think clinicians need to be way more, when they think about the risks of providing take-homes, they need to think about the risks of not providing take-homes. And they rarely ever think about those risks, which I would argue are oftentimes much greater than the risks of providing them.
Yeah, I really appreciate that framing too. I think there is this like pervasive thing, I think, in medicine where we often like get much more worried about the risks of things we do than the risk of things we don't do. And the risk of not doing this or of taking something away that wrecks people's lives, right, is humongous in this toxic, you know, drug supply that's killing 100,000 people a year. And so like, obviously there has to be some balance, but clearly the way it's balanced right now is not right too. Again, like we're kind of trying to frame this for mostly primary care and general medicine doctors. And so again, we're the Mrs. M's primary care doctor, and now she's on methadone and she's gotten some doses. Like, how do we interact with her OTP and advocate and figure out how to make methadone work for her from the primary care setting too?
I think this one is going to be actually the hardest one for our listeners to make happen. And that is right now, I bet right now, you don't know who works at your local methadone clinic. I bet you don't know who the medical director is. You don't know who staffs it. You may not even know where it's located. That's the first job. You need to figure out your local landscape, your personal local landscape. And first of all, I hope you have a local methadone clinic. And if you don't, well, that's a different episode that we're going to do in the future. And I'm just putting it out there on how to make new methadone clinics happen. But you need to know who those people are, which means you need to pick up the phone and call and say, hey, I'm a primary care doctor. I'm the medical director of a local primary care site. And we want to meet you. We want to know your policies and procedures. We want to know your walk-in days. We want to know your take-home bottles. We want to understand methadone. Will you come give us a talk? Can I pick up the phone at any point and talk to you? We do that in primary care with all the other specialties. You know, I have everybody's text number on my cell phone, right? The GI doctor, the OB, the nurse midwife, I have them all. And I call them all the time when I have a question. We should be able to do that with our local OTP. It's critically important, partly to get your patients in there, partly to advocate for them. Because in a case that David's describing, a primary care doctor calling and saying, look, do you know how well this person is doing? And I heard their bottles are being taken away. And I just want to understand that more. I wanted to understand what it is you're thinking. What can I do to document or help support this patient during this time as well, so that we don't lose them to treatment and have them have the risk of dying? We know that being on 80 or 100 milligrams of methadone is this threshold to really prevent overdose death. And the most important thing is that people have methadone in their bodies every single day. I don't care how it happens. That's the most important thing. The other thing I'm going to say to you is that in the final rule, it allows primary care to do the screening to say that David has an opiate use disorder. I'm really worried about him. He's been on bupe with me. It isn't working. He's really struggling. I'm going to send you my most recent physical. It does not have to be a complicated physical. It just has to document some vital signs and a couple physical exam findings. And your documentation as a primary care doctor that this person has moderate to severe opiate use disorder based on your evaluation as a licensed clinician. Maybe there's a drug screen there. Maybe there's a historical drug screen if you want to send that. If you have recent labs that will prevent David from having to do the labs again, and you can send it to the OTP, and that is the entry point for them to start on methadone. Now, it is the licensed clinicians on site that determine the dose. They screen, they read what you sent them, and they say, wow, David really has opiate use disorder. He needs care. I'm going to make a decision based on the referral that came from Carolyn on how I'm going to dose him tomorrow, and we'll check in with him. The OTP system has to do the physical within 14 days after that, but it's a low barrier entry. And every primary care doctor out there needs to know about this, because you may know it ahead of your local OTP. And we'll have things in the show notes that help advocate for this process.
Yeah, I feel like it's really good to hear, even though we silo methadone and treatment, like it is medical care and we should be integrating it into our primary care as much as possible instead of just throwing it on a problem list and never talking about it, right? And so I think it's great to hear that. And I think this is kind of some news to me too about the final rule and how much more of a role we can play in lowering barriers to get into the OTP as long as we get to know our local resources too. And I'll say, like, there are other things that you can talk to your OTP about too to lower barriers. Like, I know one of the local OTPs we work with, instead of taking government IDs, we'll take medical records, like with a picture and their name and address as an alternative to the government ID. And a lot of Medicaids that offer transportation benefits. So there's a lot of things you can do to facilitate kind of entry into this methadone system and helping people continue on it too.
Totally. And I think exactly like you said, Ruth, you won't know how you can help until you talk to your local OTP, because there is a ton of variability. I do want to touch upon another challenge that we face for patients who are on methadone or who maybe start methadone in the hospital, who need to go to like a skilled nursing facility, maybe for prolonged antibiotics or just for rehab because they had some injury where they would benefit for, you know, more intensive physical therapy. Because we see this issue all the time where we hear that short-term nursing facilities won't take patients on methadone. And I'm curious, Ruth, like from your point of view, how do we sort of troubleshoot this in terms of helping patients access methadone in skilled nursing facilities?
Well, I'm going to say the first strong statement, which is it is against the federal law to deny access to methadone or buprenorphine at a skilled nursing facility. It is a violation of the Americans with Disability Act, and the Department of Justice will come after you. So that's the first thing. And it depends on who your Department of Justice is, how aggressive they'll be. I'm in a part of the country where my assistant attorney goes after every single skilled nursing facility. And yet we know that skilled nursing facilities will say, oh, we didn't not take them because of the methadone. We didn't take them for 12 other reasons, most of which seem bogus. So that's the first thing. It's against the law, period. And a lot of us work in nursing homes. I mean, I worked in nursing homes forever as a primary care doctor, and it was part of my gig. And so if you're one of those primary care people out there who also sees people at a skilled nursing facility, you know, you should be working from within to make sure that that's changed. It's really just stigma. It's that people don't want that type of person in their facility. Well, you have all people in your facility, and how to advocate. So then that's why you're best friends with your OTP medical director, because you can do chain of custody, meaning that the OTP can deliver, or a nurse or somebody, anybody from the inside of the skilled nursing facility can come pick up the dose and bring it back to the skilled nursing facility to administer it. Another thing that came out in the new final rule is something that's very clear, which is that if you are a hospital, a long-term care facility, or a correctional facility who has a DEA clinic or hospital license, which almost all of us do, you actually don't need to be an OTP to use methadone. You can order methadone on your formulary from your normal pharmacy, and you can dispense it to patients. So if somebody left the hospital on 120 milligrams and you just knew this, you would just continue them on their 120 milligrams without ever interacting with an OTP system. Now, when they leave you, they need to go to an OTP. So you need to have a warm handoff spot. Otherwise, you've really abandoned a patient. So I think most people listening to this will be like, wait, what did she just say? But again, it's going to, we'll make some links that make it a little more obvious to you, and you will be explaining it to others. But this is a system, again, hasn't changed in 51 years, and a lot of things have to change really fast. And you know what we are? We're a bunch of smart people who can make change.
Yeah. This is something from my own personal experience too. Like when I was a hospitalist, I thought it was just like normal that nursing facilities just didn't accept people on methadone because there were none that did it. But it's like, it is complete obvious discrimination. Again, like there is precedence that this is a violation of the ADA. Nursing facilities have been fined, had to enter into agreements. The onus is not just on patients to advocate for themselves, right? We need to try change the system. And so that's by partnering with OTPs. That's by, you can file complaints. I do this all the time. You can file complaints, ADA complaints for patients, with patients. Link up with your local U.S. attorney and start kind of moving this process while also trying to partner with OTPs and nursing facilities to get methadone into nursing.
And change is hard. So in the meantime, pick up the phone and call the OTP. Sometimes it's just asking, hey, what nursing facilities often do chain of custody with your clinic? You know, so that way you're giving the case manager and a social worker some facilities to start with, because it can be frustrating, right? And can lead to burnout and less evidence-based care for our patients, right? So I do think if you pick up the phone and know those places while we're working to make like these bigger changes, you'll at least be able to provide some sort of support and understand what you can do locally for your patients.
I'll say like the message that I believed coming in, but I think that has really come through, is like methadone's amazing, right? It's this amazing medication in this very often broken system. And so I think this question's for you, David, but like, how do we as clinicians, as kind of general docs and everything, use our voices to change the system, to make it more accessible and person centers? Like, how do we become advocates to make this better?
Well, that's a tough question. So you're specifically clinicians. How do clinicians become better? It's a great question, because while I think some of the federal regulations, like the final rule and the COVID stuff being made permanent, I think that's all great. But as is coming out in a lot of this, there's a lot of variability because clinics have a lot of autonomy. And there's a lot of different levels, the state, the county, the mostly the clinic itself, you know, to affect the way treatment is delivered. And I think that we are going to need more than federal regulation. We're going to need treatment providers to actually have their hearts and minds change and not see methadone as being such an abstinence-based treatment for addiction, and focusing a little bit more on methadone as harm reduction. And as a way for people to live their lives in the way that they choose to do so, whether or not that conforms to complete abstinence or partial abstinence or less. I think we need to really change the discourse around methadone. It's very focused on addiction and recovery, and that sort of lends itself towards a paternalistic, top-down, abstinence-only model. Whereas, I mean, in my research, most of the people are not, their goals are not that large. Their goals are like, I want to live. I want to survive. You know, my back is pushed up against the wall. I see this as a way of getting a little bit of moving space. And that matters. And that saves lives. That's how mostly how methadone saves lives. It's not because it turns all these addicts into recovered 12-step people. It's much more in the gray area. And, you know, I don't want to make it like an old school, new school, but if clinicians can be a part of changing the hearts and minds of the people that are more like locked set in their ways, no, we got to change this person, change their behavior into what we think their behavior should be, and focus more on meeting people where they're at and you know, accepting that this real, like I still use drugs. I'm not abstinent and you know, I managed to get a PhD out of the whole thing. So like, you know, success stories are found more in the middle. And if clinicians can come around to that, and if clinicians can be a part of helping other clinicians come around to that, you know, that I think that's how we need to change hearts and minds.
I hope you have changed hearts and minds today, David, by everybody listening out there. I hope we'll have some folks really just like have a shift in their mindset with how they think about methadone.
I hope so.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I completely agree. And I'd say, like, again, you primary care clinicians, like you can kind of change hearts and minds. You can become, right, like Doc, like Ruth, you can become an OTP director eventually and make sure that an OTP has policies that are more person-centered. And again, there's some legislation moving through Congress and the federal government now to at least loosen some regulations and allow prescribing of methadone for addiction trained clinicians. And so you can become an addiction trained clinician, advocate for that. Like we need to change the system to make, again, this amazing medication more accessible. And that's as life-saving as anything that we do in medicine. I mean, for each of you, what do you feel like your big take-home points that you really want the people listening to take away from? Maybe you could start, David.
I guess I would say that as someone who's been in methadone for 20 years and seen a lot of people, as well as seen a lot of people through my research on methadone, it really, really saves lives. I mean, it really turns people's lives around. And as Ruth said, even the people who might not, you know, meet your, you know, maybe they don't become a lawyer or something like that, they're doing better than they would be without methadone. And just, I mean, the amount of benefit that it provides is so huge. And when you look at it in the context of how much we restrict that benefit and how much we hamper it, it's just terrifying and sad. And you know, we need to change that.
When I was on your first episode of Curbsiders Addiction, your first season, I think Caroline asked me what emotion I had, and it was rage. And I continue with my absolute rage that we have this amazing medicine that people don't have access to, and that most people who are prescribers don't understand at all. Like, how the heck did that happen? This should be taught in every medical school pharmacology class. Everybody should be understanding addiction inside and out during medical school and during their training. If you're a general surgeon or an orthopedic surgeon, you should be able to start people on methadone and get them stable because you're taking care of those patients right now. And, you know, over time, what I really want is I want methadone and buprenorphine not to exist in 42 CFR, and it needs to belong in the rest of the federal code of regulatory language with every other medication out there. It should never have been removed from there. It belongs with every other normal medicine, so we all know how to use it. We all know how to help people. And I'm a big believer that change happens, and actually, I have a lot of hope. I have a lot of hope for patients nationwide who are going to have improved access to this treatment.
I already said my last thing, but I have never been so optimistic about methadone. I've been on it 20 years. For the first 17 of it, I never had any hope that it was going to change. And in the last 3 years, it's been a different vibe, a different environment. And I do have much more hope than I ever did before.
Well, we're so happy to have both of you today. And I did want to ask one more thing. Is there anything you want to plug? David, let's have you go first.
Sure. Well, for anybody that's interested in participating in methadone advocacy, there's the National Coalition to Liberate Methadone. Both Ruth and I are active members, and you can find our website online and, you know, fill out a little form and join and get more involved in advocacy. It's exciting because this moment, as I mentioned, does feel like we have more potential for change. So join the fight.
I love that. And David, I totally support Liberate Methadone movement, and that organization is doing incredible work with people who are active drug users or people who are currently in methadone or both. I'm actually going to plug the Massachusetts Association of Addiction Medicine. We have a YouTube channel, and on that YouTube channel, everything is free. And we have talks, and this is could be a little bit more for OTP directors, but how to dose methadone in a fentanyl era is one of those talks. How to dose methadone for people who are pregnant. All free YouTube channel, Mace Sam. On the YouTube. And again, it's just education to make sure you're doing the right thing in the year 2024 with a toxic drug supply.
Great. Well, it was so incredible to have you guys both here today. Thank you for your time. And we'll make sure to post all these links in our show notes.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thanks for having this.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders miniseries, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get your show notes now at thecurbsiders.com/addiction.
We are committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, review on Apple Podcasts, and feel free to send us emails at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. We love hearing from y'all about episode ideas, what you thought, how this has changed your practice. And so a special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support, as well as ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Learn more about the organization at ACAM, that's ACAAM.org. A special thanks to our whole team at Curbsiders that always helps us with these episodes. We are produced and edited by the team at PodPace. And until next time, I've been Sean Cohen.
A reminder that this and most of our episodes are available for CME credit for health professionals at curbsiders.vcohealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan. Thanks for listening in and checking out season 3 and letting us bring you guys some addiction medicine pills.